This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Good evening. Thank you all for coming for tonight's event with Michael Blum and Glenn Lowry. The event's titled Notre Histoire, Our History, sometimes known as Our History, Notre Histoire. We've noticed online and here. Which I perhaps is part of what the project is about. And we're very thrilled that Michael could be here to present this project to us. And we're also very happy that Glenn Lowry, director of the Museum of Modern Art, could be here. Michael, I have known for a long time and did a project in Cabinet Issue 3 back in 2001. So it is at least 14 years, Michael. But he's been in Montreal since 2010. And his past projects include a tribute to Safia Bahar, a museum dedicated to the secret lover of Mustafa Kemal Ataturk. True story.
Of course.
Perhaps. Exodus 2048, which staged a possible future in the Middle East. That was at the Van Abbe Museum in Eindhoven in 2008, and the New Museum in New York in 2009. And Palazzo Chupi, an investigation of Julian Schnabel's West Village Palazzo, and the relationship between art and real estate. And that was shown at Optica Montreal in 2015. He's a professor at the École des Arts Visuels et Médiathèques. Médiathèque, thank you.
Yeah. Welcome.
At UQAM in Montreal. And bloomology.net has a lot more information about Michael. And Glenn Lowry is the sixth director of the Museum of Modern Art and has lectured and written extensively on contemporary art and the role of museums in society. And for many years, he was also director of the Art Gallery of Ontario, hence part of his interest in tonight's event. Please welcome Michael and Glenn.
Thank you, Sina. I would like to start with by thanking Sina and Jaffe and Cabinet for hosting this event, Glenn Lowry for accepting to be part of it. Also Dorothée Schall for being the first one who put into my head the idea of presenting this project in New York. I see that the room is laid out with two sections of seats, so maybe if there's any Francophones that should sit here and Anglophones there. Thank you. But if you don't want to, you don't have to. I'm going to first lead you through the exhibition. Just to do a kind of a virtual visit, and then I'll have a conversation with Glenn in which you will take part as well. So the project is called, depending on the language we speak, Our History, Notre Histoire, or Notre Histoire, Our History. It took place last fall in the Galerie de l'UQAM in Montreal, which is a university gallery. And I'm starting just to give you a sense of the space with a sketch that I did about 9 months before the show opened. So it's not exactly that, but it's very close. It gives you a sense of at least those three spaces. Here you have the entrance with the neutral space, where you have the blue wall and the red wall designate two entrances to respectively the Quebec Museum and the Canadian Museum. Both museums have a common exit in this corridor here. So it's really the idea of having in one space a neutral space and these two museums that tell the same story from two different perspectives. So this is the entrance. You see the round table with 11 stools and 11 books. This is the book, which I had here, but it disappeared. It doesn't matter. The book is what started the project. It's the project actually started with a poll, a series of five questions I sent to about 500 to 600 respondents, out of which 86 responded, and the book has all these responses. The poll had five questions, which I'm going to try to remember, or I'm going to grab a book there. If I move the mic, the first one is thank you. What is Quebec for you? The second one is, how would you explain the difference between Canada and Quebec to a foreigner? The third one, if a museum had to preserve the history of the differences between Canada and Quebec, how would you envision it? 4, how would you see the relations between Canada and Quebec within 2 or 3 generations? And 5, what common language other than English or French could we use? And there was a 6th, any comment, so you people could also comment on it. So the book was available, so when you entered the space, this is the space of the book, which is the only element that is for both French and English speakers. On the walls, there's no more blue and red walls like I had initially planned, but the two entrances of both museums are just designated with a quote of two authors that represent their respective cultures, Michel Tremblay for Quebec and Mordecai Richler for Canada. And the quotes are in French, on est toujours le folklore de... Do I quote this right? On est toujours le folklore de quelqu'un d'autre. So one is always the folklore of someone else. And the one by Mordecai Richler is, which we have here, is Canadians are history's couch potatoes. So let's enter the Quebec Museum. It starts like any museum with a wall text that contextualizes the museum. It really sets the tone with the title. So the title is Notre Histoire. L'histoire vraie du Québec enfin révélée, the true story of Quebec finally revealed. So it really sets the tone of the museum. Then you enter a second room that's just behind it that has this big rock that's called the Holy Rock, which grounds the very origin of Quebec. You will see in the Canadian Museum there's also a link to geology. So both these cultures are grounded in a geological origin. It has to do with, of course, cultures that are looking for something tangible and very material for as an origin of their culture. But it's also a reference to all the natural resources that exist under our feet, both in Quebec, in Canada and Quebec. Across it, you have a wall text that explains what this Holy Rock is, and it's actually a fragment of the meteorite that formed the Manicouagan, which is where the pointer is. You see in northern Quebec, there is this huge crater which was formed by a meteorite. So this Holy Rock is a fragment of it. And this image is quite, I really like it, because it's the same thing but seen from the International Space Shuttle, so from space. So you see it's something really big you can see from space, so Quebec exists even from space. When you go into the next room, that's the view you have with the first room and the second one you see in the back. This room is called, the first one, it's called the Modern Times, Very Modern Times, and Not So Modern Times Anymore, and has a lot of artifacts, very different artifacts. You can see a vitrine with several objects. I'm going to have close-ups in a second. And also in the back, you have a skull, which is the skull of Donnacona, which was an Iroquoian chief who was politely yet abducted by Jacques Cartier upon his second journey and brought back to France. And he was apparently well-treated in France, but nonetheless, he was a prisoner and he died in France. And his skull has been found when Paris Street has been repaved. It apparently has been buried under the street and was found again and brought back to Quebec. On the left, what you see is a manuscript of a text written by André Breton in Percé in the Gaspé Peninsula, where, as you all know, he wrote the text, the novel Arcane 17 in 1944. And at the same time, he wrote Synapse, this other text, that was about his all his sexual, very intense sexual experiences with his new lover and who would become his wife, Elsa Claro. And this text is so erotic that only the backside can be shown because the text is just too offensive. So it's the backside of this manuscript you have. You can imagine the text, but you cannot actually read it. Uh, This is now the contents of the vitrine. I have several things. This is an art project of a young emerging artist called Jérémy Bourdois, who's the great-grandson of famous Quebec artist Paul-Émile Bourdois. And his project is to draw on a grain of rice all the flags of the 196 countries in the world, plus some aspiring one, among them, of course, Quebec. So this is his grain of rice for Quebec, but of course there's about 200 others. This is a censer that has like a religious origin, but that was also used simply to better the air of bathrooms. This is a collection of Christian texts that was the unofficial constitution of Quebec under the regime of Maurice Duplessis, who was ruling Quebec from 1936 to 1959. This is the horn that sounded the defeat at the very famous Battle of the Plains of Moïse, which took place in 1759, where the French were defeated by the Brits. And that was the beginning of the downfall for French North America. In the same vitrine, this is a bowl that used to belong to famous author and nationalist Pierre Valliere, who had it. I don't know if you can read French, but this crazy story about the origin. I'm not going to get into all the details, but there's always, as you see already in the Quebec Museum, there are a lot of stories and a lot of texts, so there's a lot to read. It's a very didactic museum. This is the pillbox of a revolutionary leader of the Métis people from Winnipeg, Louis Riel, who also had severe mental health issues, so he needed a big box to fit all these pills. And this is the famous Quebec hourglass, which is an hourglass that has lost the ability to count time. This is a wooden relief, called The Sharing of the Riches, which depicts the sharing of the riches spoiled from First Nations peoples by Brits, by fighting and struggling Brits and French. The Brits are in red, the French are in green. A few details that show you a little more of the action. And what is interesting is in this image, there is some kind of more trivial action going on with, I don't know if the central character is pinching the butt of the other one or stealing the wallet, but I would go for the latter because you see his accomplice on the left who's leaving the scene, running away. So we can imagine it's a trick and they were actually stealing their wallets. And this shows you that termites have a lot to do with the story and that this is actually very old and that eventually it will crumble to dust. This is the view of the room after. You have what is in the foreground is a little porcelain statue called Our Lady of the Agonizing with a severed head. And behind Les Glorieuses Réalisations is the great Quebec Wall of Shame, basically. It's everything that is related to corruption and failure in Quebec, and there's a lot of it, of course. Also, I forgot to say that the border between these two rooms, there's something crucial going on because funding has been cut. And so from this moment on, the walls aren't painted anymore. Everything is handmade. There's trash in the background. It's been left in the middle waiting for more funding to come and eventually finish the museum. So you can vaguely see on both sides of the wall that it's not very orderly. On the left, you have something like a bed for the artist to take a nap when he's tired. And on the right, you just have a pile of materials waiting to be carried away. So you see these made-up benches are actually for people to sit and watch the slideshow that you see in the back. And in the foreground, you also see wellness image that nothing's been painted, the walls are raw. And the statue of Saint Unknown is still in the crate because, yeah, no one could take him out of the crate, so that's how he's exhibited. And the slideshow in the back is documents. It's about 45 minutes and documents the land, the people, their history, their culture. So it's a mix of many different pictures. Sorry, there I'm coming back to Saint Unknown. A few details, and you can see that the Sacred Heart has been removed. And this is also kind of typical for Quebec, which used to be very religious, but at some point became completely non-religious, and all the religious signs were removed from everything. So here the Sacred Heart was removed and just filled in with a newer piece of wood. That are just examples of pictures from the slideshow. You can see that, there's imagery of First Nations people. This is the execution of the Quebec Patriots in 1839. This is a reminder of the two lost referendums, lost for independence in 1980 and 1995. And this is the great national dish, poutine. Which is basically just, for those of you who don't know, it's just white fries and gravy.
And cheese.
And on the corner on the right, you pass the corner, and there's already a sign that you're going to hit the exit soon. It's the end of the history. And there's a drawn map of Quebec. Au revoir et à bientôt. And then you follow an arrow and you notice that everything is pristine again. It's clean, it's white, it's beautiful. You follow this arrow, and this is probably more familiar to Europeans because this is a rereading of the European sign for emergency exit. But you notice that the rectangle has become a trapezium. And this is what you enter if you take a left. So it's this long hallway that exits, that's the end of the museum, with an exaggerated perspective in the sense that the entrance is large, but the door frame you see in the back is only 2 feet, 2.5 feet wide and 6 feet high. So it's shrinking and shrinking, and if you're tall, you need to make a little effort to exit. And once you're out, this is the counter shot, this is where you exit, and you're back in a neutral space with the books. And if you take a left, you arrive at the court of Mordecai Richler, and you take another left again to enter the Canadian Museum, which also begins with a wall text that explains what the museum contextualizes and explains what the museum is about. But as the Quebec text was a narration, and a kind of a talkative one. There were four paragraphs, and it was a very talkative style. The Canadian one is much drier, and it's actually an existing text that the government of Canada has written for its prospective immigrants that are very, very lightly altered. But obviously, I can hear some of you who found what has been altered, but it's very close to the original. Also, the list of sponsors are comments about what's going on right now in Canada, where the Harper government is trying to, because Canada, is 150 years old, not more, and it's a country basically without a history, and the Harper government is trying to create a history out of nothing. And there's two themes that Harper likes very much and is trying to push to the foreground, to have them become pillars of Canadian culture. It's the idea of the North and 1812. So the list of sponsors, that's why I include 1812 Inc. And also the famous circle of Canadian creationists that gave a few ministers to the Harper government. Then you enter a room about Proto-Canada where you see in the middle, it's the Holy Hole, which is the equivalent of the Holy Rock. So the rock is protruding and the hole is the opposite, but it also has in common this idea of geology as a grounding field of our culture.
And it's a hole out of which come essences that are Canadian essences and that make anyone breathing around become a Canadian citizen. The history of Proto-Canada, I've just kind of reread it the other way around, because the history you've been told so far is that some Europeans arrived on the East Coast and eventually they found themselves on the West Coast. Well, actually, it was the other way around. The first settlers of Proto-Canada came from Asia over the Bering Strait. They first settled in what is now British Columbia in the outpost called Vancouver, which later became Vancouver. And they moved slowly to the east until they hit the Atlantic Ocean. So this is the true story. This is the explanation of what the holy holes are. I'm going to move forward, but if you really want to read, I can come back to it. And you also have two vitrines, one with hunting tools from the Pleistocene period here, and the other one documenting more art and trade. So you can see pictures, objects, little masks, and diverse artifacts. I can also come back to it, but now it's just an overview. More images. I really don't know what's funny, but... this is also, because we're in Canada, authority is really there, so we have to watch out. We have to remind visitors that they're always under surveillance and they cannot do whatever they feel like. And then we enter the main space, which is divided into rooms or two sections. The first one is also a slideshow, but a little more orderly than the previous one, so we have proper chairs, uncomfortable but clean and good-looking. It's also images, also about, if you want to see the whole slideshow, it's about 45 minutes as well, and it's also documenting Canada, so it's the land, the people, their culture, and their history. And then you enter, of course, the great section of Canada's greatest inventions. As you all know, Canada provided us with amazing inventions, and among them, the snowblower. Here, a great model called Snowboy from 1953 with the original dust and grease on it. The walkie-talkie, the egg carton, the Macintosh apple, the Caesar cocktail, changed daily in the exhibition, the Trivial Pursuit, the garbage bag without the content, the paint roller, and they're all true Canadian inventions. Mashed potatoes, this stands for Standard Time, was also a Canadian invention, and of course, Canada Dry. After this section, you pass the wall, you take a left, and you find yourself in this hallway, which is here. This is a counter shot, so you usually don't see this, unless at the end of the hallway you look back. And you have the same exit as Quebec, so the two museums are completely separate, but they share this common exit. And this I found extremely interesting, because on the left, it's Le Devoir, which is the main quality French-speaking daily in Montreal. And on the right, it's the Gazette, the only remaining English-speaking daily in Montreal. And they all wrote on this exhibition, but each of them chose a picture from its museum and its culture. So instead of doing a little intercultural work and putting, you know, the Canadian Museum in the French-speaking press and vice versa, everyone was sticking to its own culture. And if I push it one step further, Cabinet has taken its sides and has decided to work on the Canadian side, because I gave two images and Cabinet has chosen this one. So it's also echoing exactly what I'm talking about, that basically we just go for what we already know. This is it for a quick overview. I didn't want to talk for too long. Is there any detail you want to see, or things that didn't go into detail enough?
It said warning to non-Canadians on one of the...
Yes. It's basically, here. I don't know if you can read it. Actually, I have all the texts with me. It's basically warning non-Canadians that if they stick around, they're going to become Canadian because they're going to breathe the essences. That's what it's telling them.
In your headlines that you had pictures of just about three or four slides ago, I noticed on the English side, warped view of Canadian identity.
You mean in the newspaper?
Right. If you go back on two slides, two or three slides.
This?
I think that's it. If you close up, there you go. More reflection of identity.
Yeah. Yeah. It's quite amazing. Montreal is something special. This project was trying very hard to ignore Montreal because Montreal is what contradicts all of this. Because everything gets together and mixed up, and you can't distinguish them. So everything that was related to Montreal in the exhibition, I just kept out of it, because it would contradict these purity principles.
Would you suggest because Montreal is in essence a bilingual international city in some ways, like New York or London or Hong Kong, people are sophisticated, educated, don't feel threatened by the other because they're used to being with that. But then when you leave Montreal, it becomes more tribal, for want of a better word.
I'm not sure. I mean, we could say it's like New York and Hong Kong. I think it's a little, it's not quite the same in the sense that... what happened?
We're not going to leave two solitudes. We can't allow
no.
that.
No, exactly. But Montreal, most people in Montreal are bilingual. And life in Montreal is bilingual and bicultural, and there's many more communities, as you say, like in New York or anywhere, in any big city. But the politics are always trying to separate that. So, yeah, you're totally right. That's exactly what I meant.
Thank you, Glenn, for joining us. What's the structure now? Would you guys like to sort of...
Well, it's very informally. Uh-huh. I was so keen, because I could speak for hours about this, so I thought I should really do a quick tour and not speak for too long. So I think now we can turn it into a discussion.
So maybe would you like to say some words, Glenn? Or?
Well, we can certainly go back and forth and into this. Well, first of all, truth in advertising... I'm married into the very issue Michael is talking about. My wife, I kid you not, my wife's family on both sides, her father and her mother's, reflect these two very different strands of Canadian culture. My wife's family arrived in Canada in the 17th century and are French. And on her mother's side, and on her father's side, arrived in the 18th century and are English. And surprisingly, both her mother and father got along really well with each other because they're from Montreal. So I want to begin with reception and how a project like this is received in Quebec and in Montreal, because I was struck by the difference between this project and Safia Behar, where if I read Safia Behar correctly, even if you were a thoughtful Istanbuli, there was enough give in your game that you could actually have thought, maybe there was this Jewish lover, and how did we not know about it? And I think there was even a bit of media attention on that front. Whereas you give many clues here that you're playing with a lot of these issues. And so did you want to make sure that your audience understood that you were using satire or were you at a different game? In other words, I'm curious as to how you were trying to position this relative to a, let's call it, Canadian audience, to use the most broad umbrella.
I think what the two projects have in common is that they tackle a history that is kind of fossilized or overwritten. But in the case of... here, there was, in the case of Safi Behar, yeah, it was very subtle. Here, it was obvious that I was working with satire. But it was very, I was walking on a thin line because I was addressing basically two audiences, the English and the French-speaking ones, that are very different. And I didn't want to offend anyone. Yet, I wanted to provoke, but without offending. So there was a very thin line, and I spent a lot of time very carefully writing the texts to manage, basically to make sure that the satire is very well understood and that people don't get pissed. Of course, some people did get pissed, but that's always the case. But the point is that here was you're using satire very openly, and also I set the tone right from the start. It's hard to miss. I mean, if you take this seriously, it's a little sad, but I don't know how it's even possible. With Safi Behar, it was very different. But if I think about it, it also has something else in common, is that both pieces are based on the fact that the audience knows this history very, very well. So there's not too much contextualization that needs to be done because people know the history. So, you know, I can take from there and continue. That was the case with Safi Behar. Even though Safi Behar was also addressing two audiences, the Turkish one and the European one. And of course, for the Europeans, you had to contextualize a little bit. But the Turks, they knew the history of Atatürk by heart, any single one of them. So that was very easy. And as an artist working with this history, it's fantastic because you don't need to contextualize. Everyone knows right from the start what it's about. In this case, it's the same, but it's much more controversial because you have these two histories, and that's why I did this piece also in the beginning, because you arrive in a place and that has really these two histories. Quebec is almost an accident of history. It should be a different country. It has a whole different set of references from English Canada, and yet they're still the same country. So, of course, there's a great deal of friction, and that's exactly in this area of friction that I wanted to work.
So the challenge in Quebec always, especially in Montreal, revolves around language. Right? It's the language laws that become flashpoints in these discussions. So did you think about how you articulated the museum in English versus how you articulated the museum in French, and how were you using language to kind of get at the essence of these cultural divides?
I think it's language, of course, but it's a little more than language. It's language, it's culture, it's religion, so it's everything. You know, Quebec is Catholic, I mean, originally, and English Canada is Protestant, and you see it in the relation to money, to pleasure. It's amazing. I mean, it's still like this today. So I pushed it beyond language. So the language is different, but also the character of the two museums are very different. I made a Quebec museum, as you saw, that is basically the reference of the Quebec museum was a 19th century, dusty, talkative, messy little museum. I would have loved to make it even messier and dustier. And the Canadian one, and the Quebec one with too much content, and the Canadian one is the opposite. It's pristine, it's clean, it's professional, it's very beautiful, but it's lacking in content a little bit.
And emotion.
And emotion.
So I was really struck as I was looking at this, and we'll come to the book in a moment because I think that's important too, but as I was looking at this, how many of you were in Venice so far? Well, when you go, good. When you go to, yes, Joan. She didn't get to move. She was Venice. And it's great to see you, Joan. But if you were in Venice and you went to the Canadian Pavilion, which was produced by a Quebecois collective, To my mind, it has an enormous amount of resonance with this, because they were, BLG, I think is their name, that they go by, and it was absolutely spoofing the essence of the local Quebec 7-Eleven, which is called a dépanneur, which is, you know, dépanneur is to get you out of trouble, to get you out of a breakdown. And to my mind, they were tapping in a kind of parallel way to all those things that are so utterly peculiarly Quebecois, right? That, and so one of the things that struck me when I was in Venice and strikes me now is, does this translate? Is there something here that anyone, that someone utterly unfamiliar with Canada or Quebec would get? Or are these issues hyper-localized?
I mean, in the case of Bégiel, I don't know. I wasn't in Venice. I haven't seen the piece, so I just wouldn't talk about it. I mean, I've seen documentation, but I just prefer not to talk about it. How does it translate? I think it is very local, and that's also what interested me a lot in doing a presentation in New York. It's the translability of a project like this. So for me, it's almost experimental to see if it's translatable, if you can bring this somewhere else, and also if you can make it interesting for another audience. Because of course, for a local audience, it is interesting because it is there. But for another audience, it's really the question of the not the global in this case, but like of changing scale, of moving the work elsewhere, and seeing if it can make sense in just another location. And of course, I find myself now presenting this project, and I realize I have to almost I would need ideally to explain everything, translate everything, because you just have no idea. So it is very local in this sense. And maybe it was more difficult than, for instance, Safi Behar, which was very local, but because of the attention that was put on Turkey in this, that was in 2005 at this moment, because there were negotiations about the inclusion of Turkey in the European Union, and there was a lot of discussion in Europe about Turkey. So there was this double perspective. In the case of Quebec, I'm always, and even Canada, I'm always amazed to see, for instance, in the U.S. that it doesn't reach here. I often meet people in the U.S. who don't even know that there's a French-speaking province in Canada, or who basically ignore anything north of the border. And that's really amazing for me. It's something I still don't really understand, or not fully understand.
It's fascinating. I mean, if you think about how close we are to Canada, I mean, a couple hundred miles, and you're in Quebec from here, and how big Canada is. The United States is Canada's largest trading partner, and we share, you know, vast border, mineral wealth, oil, and there is a kind of ignorance. I think people probably know more about France or Mexico or Germany than they know about Canada. I bet you if you took a poll of any random 10 New Yorkers, they would know who Angela Merkel was, and they'd have no clue who Stephen Harper was, even though in a very important way, Harper has a huge impact on this country. So there is this kind of strange lack of awareness and lack of understanding, which is why I was asking you that question, because I thought it was so smart in Safi Behar to take Kemal Atatürk, somebody that internationally is known. So there was you were foregrounded immediately, and here you, which is I think a very typical Canadian story, you get to the microscopic very quickly. You're in the weeds without that universal point of entry.
Mm-hmm. It came. It's also a kind of autobiography, because I moved there, and I've been moving quite a lot in the last decades, and it's, I think, the third time that I'm moving a piece on a new country I'm moving to, and I think when I'm moving to a new country, I need to do a piece about this country. So in this case, it was my way of dealing with this, and it just... I couldn't find, let's say, a universal aspect, and I had to tap into the ultra-local. And that's what fascinated me too. And I guess it says also something about the culture there that is maybe not so connected to the global networks, in a sense that whatever is local is hard to connect to more global networks.
Yeah, maybe it's even willful. I mean, in Quebec, you're immediately divided into linguistic groups: Francophones, Anglophones, and does anyone know what Michael is? An allophone. Which I actually think is much more interesting than being an Anglophone or a Francophone. But, you know, that you get categorized in ways that, you know, we would never, in many cultures would never actually think that it's important to, and those categorizations aren't abstract. They define what schools you can go to. They define what, ultimately, what kinds of jobs you can get. And I think this is one of the things that we assume, I think, as in a kind of global way, that there's an enormous amount of freedom in Quebec or and in Canada to go to the schools you want to go to do the jobs you want to do. And in actual fact, an outcome of this, would you call it a paranoia on the part of Quebec of being subsumed into a larger Canadian culture, is to actually create, to disengage itself from the rest of the world, right? That particularity that you were talking about. So, do you think that if you took this show to Ontario, it would be understood? It would get read? Intelligently?
Probably people would probably go to the Canadian side and not to the Quebec side, I guess. Well, it would need, I think the place where it would really make sense would be Ottawa. Mm. Because Ottawa is a tiny town, but I mean, tiny town, it's like, what, 300,000? I mean, it's not a big city, but it's the federal capital, and it's the only place in Canada that is officially bilingual. I mean, that's not true. There's one province, New Brunswick, that's officially bilingual, but Ottawa, yeah. Yeah, that's true. So Ottawa is the place where it would totally make sense. Yeah, but I think elsewhere, it's. I was approached by, you know, twice, but I mean, the question came up, but it's also a big show to produce, so it didn't go very far, but I didn't really see the relevance of it. But in Ottawa, I would absolutely love to do it. Yeah, I think it would even be better in Ottawa.
Yes, people would be. Forced to, I was interested in the, you know, the great Canadian dish of poutine, which
Quebecois dish. Quebecois, you mean?
No. If you're from outside of Quebec and you come to Quebec, it's the first thing you have.
That's very interesting. It's also like there's someone who wrote one answer in the book saying Canada, Quebec is basically what Canada is celebrated for. So that's where the confusion also comes in. Is that okay? Poutine is Quebecois, but if you forget Quebec, it's Canadian, because Quebec is still part of Canada as of now.
And I noticed you didn't have any maple syrup.
I do.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. Because there's 400 slides, so I didn't show them all.
I feel much better.
Oh, yeah. But I do have it on both sides, because it's also, it's an icon in Quebec, but also in Canada, even though Canada has mostly Quebecois maple syrup, but... It's Canadian. The label is Canadian.
So let's talk about the book.
But Andrea had a question, just if it has something to do with what we were just talking about.
I was thinking when Glenn was asking the question is, you know, my immediate response that I think is actually really relevant is that what makes this project universal for me, looking at it, and I have no clue about Quebec and Canada more than my lovely friends are telling me about, but I think it's this very particular moment we're in where there is on the one hand side the discussion of the multitude and a capital globalization, and on the other side a kind of hardlining of more conservative cultural identity politics. And I think what's played out here is incredibly local, but then also really universal in the sense of what we're seeing everywhere. You know, that there's all these new histories and all these diversities, but when push comes to shove, there's this kind of hardcore simplicity, you know, around how certain things are perceived. and how certain things are categorized. And this necessity of categorization or if you look at it in an ideological sense, mass narratives. And this, no matter how many alternative histories and margins become centralized, and how, no matter how sensitive we are to all kinds of things, you know, that pop up everywhere, somehow when there's a commotion or something, it's very strongly, you know, like you walk down the street and you're either Anglophone or Francophone, right? And that's what's interesting to me, and what this project just kind of teases out for me as an outsider, is this really interesting, complex, and I think really also potentially dangerous moment culturally that we're in, you know, where you have these two poles of the multitude and the theorization of the multitude and the reality of kind of an even harder hardlining of mass narratives. And you can look at that with national cultural identities, and you can look at, you know, I was just having very interesting conversations around gender in that regard, you know. The more like the gender is dissolved, the more hardcore it becomes the way it's enforced in other places. So that's maybe for me. I was just coming up when you were asking that question.
Well, it's great to hear you say that, because I don't see it anymore. But of course, it's great to hear it.
Yeah.
But I guess I don't have enough distance, so I just see the local aspect and all the local implications and. Yeah, you're totally right. I completely agree with you, and it's great to hear. But I guess I lack the distance to see that.
You know, one of the interesting things in Quebec, which is maybe a bit of a lesson or paradigm for places like Scotland, mm-hmm. is that the Canada, the English, the Protestant Quebec that Michael references, is almost gone. In reality, both in terms of people, because over the last 40 plus years, there's been a wave of English-speaking Canadians who've left Quebec for a variety of reasons, mostly having to do with a sense of disenfranchisement and wanting to get out of the language battles, and a reality that the vast majority of Quebec, from a territorial perspective, is Francophone. So you're sort of referencing the vestiges of a Quebec that no longer exists, except possibly in Montreal.
And in the structures.
Yeah.
I feel society has evolved, but the law is still what it is. And we always reminded that, you know, of this division. What's amazing, for instance, in Montreal is that it's a multicultural city, but everything is French or English. So these two groups basically monopolize the entire culture landscape, and the others don't exist, even though there's plenty of Haitians, of Moroccans, Tunisians, Mexicans, you name it. But they have no public visibility, because everything is just French, or it's always French or English. And I mean, it's also a daily experience, you know. if you fly to or from Montreal, you arrive at the airport, then the security person inspecting your belongings, first question is like, Francais or English? And the first time I said, well, I don't care. And the guy was like, no, you choose. Forgotten in which language he said it, but it's a constitutional right to choose the language you want to be addressed in for being controlled at the airport. And it's very serious. You cannot say, I don't care, whatever you feel like. Doesn't work. So you have to choose French or English. So you fall here or there, and there's no middle. And of course, for people like me, it's the end of it.
In which language did you say, I don't care?
I don't remember. I don't remember. And of course, I mean, I'm bilingual, but most people you talk to are also bilingual, so it just doesn't make sense. And the real Montrealers, they, you know, have both languages in one sentence. And I've always been like this, and that's why I love Montreal, because I feel that's a place I can do that. In the poll?
Yeah,
I could have, but I didn't.
Could you be controlled then?
Well, the question on language, I ask it differently. It was like, what language other than English or French could we use? So, of course, people really got the irony, and others were like, what is this stupid question? But some people got it. I mean, I got the whole set of really, like, practical answers from, like, naming languages, you know.
Were you surprised by the responses you got?
Yes.
Give us a couple of examples.
I locked my list in the office in my bag before, but it doesn't matter. I remember some of them. What surprised me first, I mean, when you make a poll like this, you always think no one's going to get back to you. And the director of the gallery was very, very skeptical. And what was great is the quality of the answers I got. And I was expecting to get black or white answers, like fuck Quebec or we love Quebec. And actually, all the answers I got, or most of them, were really in between. So I realized institutionally it's so clear cut, but when it comes to like the individual level, it's always complicated. It's always more subtle. And I got a lot of really great responses, also of people who I thought were like, you know, hardcore nationalists, and suddenly they show this understanding that things are not so black and white, and the quality also was really high. What was interesting, I wrote about 500 to 600 people, and I got 86 got back. But these 86 were mostly culture producers and university professors, which I found great, but also a little sad. Journalists, for instance, not one got back. So, are there journalists here? No, okay. Journalists take but do not give, obviously. In this case, they didn't give anything. But once the project was there, some came to take something. But yeah, I was really, I mean, the responses, I published all of them except two, I think, and the two I did not publish were just because people responded, but then said, I do not want to be published, so I didn't keep it, which was weird, because usually people who don't want to respond, just, you don't respond, instead of responding and saying, don't use it. But anyway, I didn't use it. But all the other ones are here, and so it's in English or in French. The way I did it, I had to take a difficult decision. I had the poll in two languages, so I had to decide in which language I would address people. I think Sina before mentioned that I could have sent everyone in two languages. I could have, but that's what I don't like about Canada is when everything's translated. Instead of a book like this, you get a book like that. And when everything is translated, when you read both languages, it's just annoying. So I decided, I took the liberty or the prejudice to address people in one language or the other. So for most people, it was totally fine. And for a few, you know, wrote back like, why are you addressing me in English or in French? But, you know.
And didn't you publish in the language they responded?
Of course. Yeah. So nothing's translated, but all the answers are in either English or French.
You've talked a little bit about this being autobiographical in terms of your response to moving to Quebec. Has your sense of the country, and here I mean country writ large, but also country at its microscopic level, changed over the last 5 years?
Yes, enormously. I think I arrived also at a really interesting moment. But just, I would say, in the 2 years or the year and a half that this exhibition was in the planning, our political life changed faster than my project could change. So within 2 years, I mean, it was really crazy. I mean, I've never lived this elsewhere. Within 2 years, there was this so-called Maple Spring, the Printemps Arabe, which was a student strike turning a popular uprising, a real popular uprising like I've not ever witnessed anywhere else.
Over student fees, right?
In the beginning, it was like a student movement over student fees, but then it really became a popular uprising against the government. And everyone would go down the street. It was a real popular uprising. Amazing. So this popular uprising brought the government to, I mean, anticipated elections. The government lost. A new government came in. What's also, I mean, a digression, what's really special in Quebec and that's hard to grasp for many of us, especially Europeans, is that in Quebec, the left and nationalism go together. So for Europeans, it's a complete nonsense because nationalism usually is right-wing, but not in Quebec. And it's so, it works all together that it's almost impossible to split. So there's no political party that could claim to be liberal and not separatist. They have to say that they are for independence. So that was a difficult thing. I forgot where I was, sorry. Oop.
Popular uprising.
Yeah, the popular uprising after that. So the PQ, the Parti Québécois government, was elected on a promise that they would cancel the student fee hike and cancel the special bill that was enacted that was completely anti-democratic, that would prevent people from basically demonstrating and gathering, which they did. But quickly after that came back, I would say, the true nature of the Parti Québécois and the nationalist agenda. Also, they tried to mimic what the National Front was doing in France. Of course, a very bad idea, all this debate about national identity. They tried to set this so-called Charter of Quebec Values, which basically was against Muslims in one sentence. Let's put this very clearly. So this, and then in turn, it led also to the re-emergence of the sovereignty debate very quickly. But people were simply fed up with this. So there was another election that the PQ lost big time. And then the Liberal Party, which should be called the Neo-Liberal Party, rather correctly, came back to power with an austerity agenda. And this is also global. I mean, just very, very hardcore and very sudden. So in Quebec, what they do, and also in Canada, is they balance the books, but within 1 year. So basically, they cut everything. And that's where we're at now. And my project was planned over a year and a half. I think I was invited during the Maple Spring. And then I was slowly planning my project. But for instance, in April 2014, there was this election that the PQ lost and the Liberals won with a real landslide. I thought, okay, my project is over. I'm just going to cancel it because it's not relevant anymore. But of course, I realized that this project is much, this topic is much deeper, and actually there was still a lot of relevance to it, but there was just it brought some delay. And I realized that political life, I mean, there's also its technical things. I mean, it's the same in Canada and in Quebec. Election dates are not set. I mean, now it just changed in Canada, but in Quebec, I mean, it's completely anti-democratic, and I think this comes from the UK. It's the government, the prime minister, who can say within a month that they're calling elections. There's just a deadline, so it has to be done by this date. So they have all the cards in hands, and they called an election in February when they thought they had, you know, when things were going the right way with the charter and the sovereignty debate, and they were like, okay, let's call elections. Within 1 month, the elections came and they were out. And, you know, 1 month in the planning of an exhibition is like nothing. I mean, not much happens. So that's what was so special about political life in Quebec.
I mean, I've always struck by how intensely political, and I mean that in the sense of politics framing how people think about where they are in the world, how intensely political Quebec is, and Canada, much more so, I think, than this country. I mean, we talk about politics in the abstract, but in Canada, it's lived in real time. And these party allegiances are really meaningful. So if you're from, you know, the kind of contrast of a messy, slightly crumbling Quebec Museum with its pristine and, what shall we call it, not vapid, but pristine and almost airless Canada. It's just the difference between Montreal and Toronto, between, you know, streets that aren't cleaned well and streets that are overcleaned. So, I mean, there is there is something there that you don't have to be from Quebec to see the joke, as it were, or if it's not a joke, to see the critique of these very different ways of conceiving oneself. seems to me.
Mm-hmm. That's true, but that's also my difficulty, is that I live in Quebec and not in Anglo-Canada. So Canada for me is an idea. It's where I apply for permanent residency. It's where I, you know, pay taxes. I mean, taxes are actually divided, but it's an idea, Canada. I don't live in Canada. I live in Quebec, or I live in Montreal, but I'm definitely closer to Quebec than to Canada. So for me, it's difficult to judge, because I would need to spend a few years in Toronto, and maybe then it would be balanced. But I feel Quebec for me, I mean, just for me, Quebec is my daily reality, and Canada is an airless idea.
And do you think that's true if you lived in British Columbia or Saskatchewan, that this notion of a confederation, and Canada is not a country the way we are, it is a confederation of provinces, and those provinces have far greater autonomy across the full topography of Canada than states have in this country. So do you think that that's an inherent flaw in the Canadian system, that you end up having your allegiance and your sense of identity at a provincial level rather than at some supranational level?
I'm not sure, because, I mean, I've discovered also in Canada that there's a lot of Canadian nationalism. I was very surprised when I moved to Canada to see that, you know, to get funding, everything needs to be Canadian. And if you work in Canada, you need to work on Canada. It's very nationalistic. So that was a big surprise. But I think this dichotomy Quebec-Canada is basically Quebec-Ontario much more, because the rest, the western provinces are less English, and they're much newer too. And if you look at British Columbia, it's completely Chinese, for instance. It's more Chinese than anything else, so they're elsewhere. And when you talk about Quebec and British Columbia, I don't want to say they couldn't put it on the map, but, you know, they're four flying hours away, and they feel not really concerned. And also the few people from British Columbia who responded were like, don't you have anything better to do than these, like, stupid questions? They really did. I mean, so I think it's more like this kind of a competition between, like, it's the mirror image of France and Britain transposed into North America as, you know, Upper and Lower Canada, as it used to be called, and now Quebec and Ontario. And I have a question from also a former Canadian over there.
Maybe we should just open it up to all.
Yeah, places. Yeah, of course. I know.
In fact, there was something published in Cabinet during my time there, because I just had to share it with the world. I mean, there were things like, you know, we were expected to carry around something called Canada in a suitcase.
Marcel Duchamp lives. Marcel Duchamp lives.
Yeah, exactly. You know, to all of our meetings with PS1 or Lincoln Center. And, you know, I had to unpack. I never did it. But that was what was the task at hand, you know, to unpack the suitcase that had a maple syrup jar and, you know, give these as gifts to people, you know, in this century. So.
And without irony, I guess.
Quebec has a cultures self-represent, not only to themselves, but to outside their borders, makes me think about it a lot. So.
And the parallel thing is that Quebec, which is a wannabe country but isn't one, also has a general delegation in several places, including New York.
New York.
And it's a very aggressive office, and they're really, they're very present here. And in my opinion, they're even more visible than Canada.
They are.
I was about to say that.
Yeah.
Kind of more hipper culturally.
It's not a, the bar is really low on that front. Excuse me, sorry.
Not, I mean, Belgium, I think, is more the tragic version, and Canada is the hilarious version. That's how I read it. Yeah, and Paris, of course. Paris, huge. But for me, the big lack is Mexico, because Quebec always talks back, you know, the U.S. is always the bad neighbor and, you know, the imperialist and all of that. But I feel Quebec just looks at France, and for me, that's a big mistake strategically, because France is, it's not, sorry, Dorothy, but it's not, it's basically, it's a thing of the past, and it's not... It's not a country that is doing very well right now. It doesn't bring very much in terms of cultural production. But I'm thinking, Mexico, what is up? Why, you know, why doesn't Quebec and Mexico have stronger alliances at the expense of the gringo? You know? It would make sense politically, and it doesn't. I mean, it saddens me, but it doesn't. The only country in South America where there's like a little more relations is Brazil. But the rest of Latin America is just non-existent. And I'm thinking Mexico, because Mexico is just south of the U.S. It should totally have an alliance with Quebec. It doesn't. So?
So I have two questions, sort of on that front. The first one is obviously, I mean, one of the obvious things you can say is that the sort of Anglo-Franco competition exists precisely because it doesn't have an external enemy. So I guess my first question is, would you like us to invade you? Because then maybe we can solve your problems and give you some history. But the second question...
Are you talking to Quebec or to Canada?
But the second question is related to this, and you talked about it a little bit, and I was kind of curious if there's more in it that you hadn't really touched on, which is the geographic immensity. This is actually related to the first question of Canada and how... that geographic immensity, the sort of emptiness of Canada, right? And you talked about it in terms of geology, but this is a slightly different. It's territory, right? The only way it gets bridged is through language. And so, because language can bridge 5,000 miles, and hence the sort of Quebecois obsession with France, hence the sort of right, which is that there's this kind of thing that unites, and this is a way, another way to come at the question of what is the universal? One universal is the other, is the big other down south that can sort of come in and take over and maybe bring together the warring factions of a smaller country. But the other universal might be, in fact, that there's a kind of geographic emptiness, which in many ways, if I were to point to something that's concrete, and go, here's where I could think about what might Quebec, Canada, whatever you want to call that, be. Is there something about that? Because you started with the rock and then the empty space. I was just curious.
I didn't think so much of the territory per se, but really of the resources. And the resources are linked to the north. Because like the big region for tar sands right now, it's in northern Alberta, Fort McMurray. It's like all in the north of Alberta. And the next place, the Quebec government has this great, there's no money for anything except one thing. It's this so-called Plan Nord, which is a plan to develop like fracking in the north of Quebec, very far north. So the territory is very related to this idea of resources.
Course,
hockey,
which is of course played on this empty ice space.
What do you mean empty?
Well, it's some weirdly strange metaphorical presentation of the Canada landmass itself in some bizarre way.
But it's not more empty than a soccer field or.
The interesting thing about the way you frame the question about how do you bridge that. 4,000 miles of space has a linguistic dimension to it, which is that in Canada, radio, even more than television, is a vitally important means of communication and sharing of information. So the CBC in particular, in Radio-Canada, its French mirror, play an enormously important, disproportionately important role than radio plays, for instance, in the United States, where the distances are so great. It is actually, in a strange way, a genuinely common bond that links people. I didn't think about it until the way you framed that question, that it's, there are, mm-hmm. It's very hard to do.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
very interesting.
The two things.
Amazing Glenn Gould piece about driving across Canada and getting Petula Clark every hour or so.
And for years, hockey night in Canada, whether you were English or French, was that's what you did.
Mm.
Right? And so it unites both of your hockey metaphor and. In the linguistics.
Yeah, hockey is actually the one thing that where those divisions don't stand anymore.
Yeah.
And Joan had a question? Yeah.
No, I'm sort of listening to I like the idea of it. Well, there's plenty of people coming from Canada. But you haven't mentioned the Maritimes. And that, that you mentioned Vancouver. And the Maritimes are sort of left out. And if Quebec seceded, the Maritimes would be totally isolated from the rest of Canada. Mm-hmm. So being in the Maritimes, they're economically deprived areas, sort of like the Appalachia of Canada. And they all have to go to Alberta, to the tar sands. Everybody, all the men have to go out there to work. It's really tragic on one level. Never consider that side of Canada you haven't mentioned. Nobody's mentioned.
I don't go too much into each province. It's the idea of Canada as opposed to Quebec. So, of course, it doesn't make sense. And it's, for instance, in the poll, it's A.A. Bronson, to every question he answers, but what the fuck? It doesn't make sense. It's like comparing a family and a husband. And that's true. But culturally, they're just so different that you can distinguish them. But I know that conceptually there's like a flaw there.
It's a little bit the same. The Scottish culture is the dominant tourist and fiddle music, and then there are French players too, and they were all kicked out by the English, and they went to Louisiana. Mm-hmm. They had to go down to Mississippi. But there's similar dichotomies. It's sort of like, it's not like New Brunswick, but there's a French town near me, Cheticamp, where everybody can speak French.
And Nova Scotia was settled by French, I think, before Quebec, yes. Also. It's okay. Where the first settlers came, yeah. Yeah, that's true. I just didn't look at these, like, each of the provinces.
I was just thinking about mm-hmm.
But I see it also as, you know, it's like migrations. Like, Quebecois in the 19th century went in masses to New England. And now when you go to New England, like, you see a lot of French names. In the 19th century. So wherever there is poverty, people go where there's, you know, money and work just to survive. And of course, because Quebec was so poor for so long that there was a whole exodus in the second part of the 19th century mostly, where all those Quebecers went to the Boston region to work.
So the Cape Bretoners. I mean, so mm-hmm. all the people.
Yeah. And now it's Fort McMurray. Yeah, they all go there to the tar sands because you make a lot of money. And in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, there's, I guess, not much work. I mean, it's very isolated.
Of course, I mean, it has to be mentioned. And I feel like it's in the subtext of the work, but you can see it. So I feel we're also looking at an old European battle that has just played out post-colonially in another country, because neither of these cultures are indigenous to the territory we're actually talking about. So there's, for me, I mean, you're using tropes and artifacts in both of these exhibitions that smell indigenous. And can you talk about the way, is there a point you're making between how the British treated, you know, the traditional landowners, and how the French did, or is that something where those two places unite? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I didn't go. I mean, the point of this work was to stage the ills and not correct them.
Yeah.
So I just took the view of Quebec and the view of Canada, yeah. And. And the native people are very important in mythology, but of course they were completely, I mean, as we now know, treated, I mean, they were treated horribly, but they are part of the mythology.
Yeah.
And it is, I didn't go into there because it is, I mean, they just appear in the slideshows, but in a kind of a similar way. And there are differences, but not on the big picture. But there are differences, but it was just a little off my topic, in a sense that there was much more intermarriage in Quebec. So basically, it's the big one of the big dramas of Quebec is that Quebec claims to be French or French origin, but actually it should be French and Aboriginal. And because every family has like some grandmother who came from a tribe, or it's almost every family. And also, it's obvious when you're there. You're, like, you see people. It's so obvious, but it's completely pushed under the carpet. So I think that's a big drama. And only now it's starting to come out a little bit as something that actually, wow, it's something positive, and we should look at it as also our heritage. But here, for instance, that's an example of how I worked with this, kind of almost negating any kind of serious discourse about this, because I just didn't have the space, and I think it was not the right space for that. But you see those three seals here. The central one is an Innu artifact, a real Innu artifact. The right one is a dollar store copy that I bought for $2, and that is hollow. And the left one is some little, it's actually seal, proper seal fur. And obviously, a lot of people in Canada know these. A lot of people told me, oh, I had this as a toy in the 60s or 70s, but it came from a flea market in Paris. So I think it's probably some people who bought it in somewhere in Canada, brought it back to France, and then it came back. But here in the museum, they presented the three of them together. So also as a way to show that, you know, all these, this cultural appropriation is just really just a fiction. Because maybe even if you don't know the history, you can see that they look very different. Similar, yet different.
Foreigner and Israeli who settled in Montreal since outsider, so you're looking at both of them at a distance without having internalized the issues of either the Anglophones or the Francophones. Are you making an exhibition and an awareness of the situation that might be different if somebody, be the Anglophone or Francophone from Montreal, who grew up in the middle of it, maybe only an outsider such as yourself can come in there and have and just look around and see things that people who are in the middle of it cannot see for themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Totally. I would just say I have internalized a lot of it because 5 years is long. Also, I work in a French-speaking university there. So I deal with this like really on a daily basis. So I have completely internalized it. And I think after 4 years, I'm at this middle point where I know the topic well enough to develop this project. But if I would wait for another 2 or 3 years, I would be too much of a local and I would just be hindered and I wouldn't do anything. Also, I have to add, I did this project because I did a research and I found one example of a culture producer who addressed this topic. Because everyone is running away from it. Because it just, everyone is jaded, and also you don't get funding, because that's why everyone was, oh yeah, funding too much, yeah, it's just, you wouldn't get funding for a project like this. And people are just so sick of it, they don't want to hear about it. So, yeah, it does take an outsider to deal with it, and at the same time, yeah, I felt I knew enough to tackle that. And I felt also entitled. What I heard also, because of course when you come to Quebec as an outsider, you don't dare criticize anything, especially if like me or Barbara, we work in a French-speaking university, we're not really free to talk very critically. And what I heard from a lot of immigrants is how cathartic it was and how great it was, because it was basically expressing what they felt but could not express. And I would include myself. Like I did this on the satiric mode because I couldn't say it on any other level. So it had to come out like this. It's the only way I had to just say that. But really, no culture producers have worked on this. I found one example. It's a filmmaker, Anglo-Montreal filmmaker who passed 2 years ago called Peter Wintonick, who in the mid-90s did a film called The Quebec-Canada Complex, where he looks at the situation from the perspective of psychoanalysis. So he goes to analysts, and it's really about the relation of these two bodies from a psychoanalytical perspective.
Well, there was a popular film that dealt with this.
What?
Good Cop, Bad Cop.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it which, if you'll remember the opening scene, the body falls from a helicopter and is pierced by a sign that says "Welcome to Quebec" and falls half on one side and half on the other, and from which becomes these incredibly complicated juridical questions of who has authority to do the investigation and what is the story ultimately about? Hockey. So, you know, it's the only thing that, as you were talking, I could think, okay, that's a send-up of the problem.
Well, Nina and Barbara? Nina?
I'll just put it, because this is like adding to what Ben just said. I mean, also I feel this bizarre and extreme humor industry with Just for Laughs that's kind of horrible, that's housed in Quebec and Montreal. I somehow feel that there's so much about that as well that comes into this, you know, that kind of addresses a lot of those issues for the better and for the worse, but always filtered through this, you know, taking this, I mean, this kind of this psychoanalytical analysis of the self is, of course, you know, more comes closer to that. But I remember when you first mentioned this idea, I also thought of that kind of bad humor or good humor, you know, like,
well, if you mention Just for Laughs, it's not really good humor.
No, yeah. I'm saying, because Regina's like, there's a lot of comedians. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a history of vaudeville, there's a lot. I mean, there's always these like dialectics, but this fetishism of dialectic, which is really lived in that space.
Well, so in that vein, I guess I was curious, in that humor is always a great revealer of things, if there were moments in either museum that people always laughed at, or you always witnessed a reaction to, like, where you really sort of got people, like, in a people couldn't help themselves kind of moment.
I wasn't in the exhibition all the time, but I have to say that was, of course, for me a great kick, is that each time I went, I did hear people laugh. It was more on the Quebec side, because it's an easier laugh, I guess. And what I heard also from the attendant is that a lot of people were using their cell phones to check facts. So that's a new thing I've been in general about exhibition making. Is that, you know, like when people read something outrageous, they Google it right away to see if it's true or not. So it makes our job a little more difficult because, you know, it's unfair competition. But yeah. Yeah. Or just block like all cell networks. I did get a lot of feedback, but mostly from staff and faculty, a little from students, but not much. Also, you just get feedback when it's really extremely for or against, but usually the others just don't tell you anything. And as for McGill and Concordia, I don't know. I don't think it would have been so different because, yeah, UQAM is seen as like the, you know, the temple of Franco activism, but that's the institution. The people are very different, you know, like 10% of professors are Anglo, students come from everywhere, there's lots of French right now. My feeling at Concordia would not have been very different. It would have been very different, like in another province, or maybe in Quebec City, or Quebec City. I mean, it wouldn't. Yeah, it's like I don't know. It's like Toronto wouldn't. You know, I would have just shown like one of the museums there, and maybe another one elsewhere. But I think UQAM and Concordia. It's just the two. In just to explain, in Montreal, you have four universities. Two speak French, two speak English, and within which language group, one is more liberal and one is more conservative. So Concordia is the other. It's the English-speaking, more liberal university. If you agree with that, but I think it's. But I think in Concordia wouldn't have been so different. I think, but I can only guess. Because it's Montreal, and in the end, it's the same audience. It's not just people from UQAM who came. There were a lot of people from UQAM, but there were a lot of people from elsewhere. And once it's in the Gazette, there was also something in CBC, so once it's in English speaking, the radio is just an amazing, I mean, Glenn mentioned it for crossing distances, but it's also an amazing medium because of its quantity of, I mean, the audience is just huge. Whatever is on the radio, like, everyone hears it. And I remember, like, when I moved to Quebec, I was invited to speak about another piece on the Radio Canada, so the French-speaking radio, public radio, for maybe 5 to 10 minutes. And they aired it again, and a lot of people told me, "Oh, I heard you on the radio." And they obviously aired it like even like months later, and I mean, they stretched it for a long time. And I always had people, you know, I do shows, no one tells me about them, but the thing on the radio, everyone heard it. So, yeah.
Super. Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you so much.